Linda Ellerbe is one of our most respected and outspoken broadcast journalists. She has functioned as a network news correspondent, anchor, writer, producer, and heads her own production company, Lucky Duck Productions. Ellerbe is a symbol for a different type of reporter. Literate, funny, irreverent, and never condescending.
On November 30th, the Assembly for the Academic Senate for the 9 campuses of the University of California will meet. About what? Sex between students and professors. There is an official proposal to condemn sex as unprofessional, to outlaw it. The man who wrote the proposal teaches history at Berkeley, part of the University of California. Apparently, he has not learned much from history, since he hopes the new rule will be enforced, quote, through the strength of moral suggestion. He says that mutual attraction between students and faculty is a natural sort of thing, but that it is inappropriate for such relationships to begin in the classroom. He does not suggest what would be an appropriate place for such things to begin. Nor does he explain his remark that he has many friends who have married their students. Perhaps they don't have sex. Well, the proposal has led to debate, with the chairman of the assembly getting my vote for the prize remark. He said this is going to require some kind of careful research. Right. There are 30,000 students at Berkeley, Professor, and just 3,000 teachers. Research indeed.
As a Texan, she started her TV career at KHOU in Houston in 1972. New York came calling a short time later, landing her at WCBS, and by 1976, she was on to the big leagues. NBC News.
This is NBC News Update, brought to you by American Express Traveler's Checks. Here is Linda Ellerbe.
Good evening. One Israeli compared it to the landing of men on the moon. And if it was not that strange, it was close. In Jerusalem, the flag of Egypt and the flag of Israel, side by side. The president of Egypt, Anwar Sadat, and the prime minister of Israel, Menachem Begin, side by side. Speeches to the Israeli parliament, no specific concessions from either country. To many Israelis, Sadat was too tough. To many Arabs, he was not tough enough. Tonight, a working dinner. Tomorrow, a joint news conference. There is no agreement on peace in the Mideast tonight, but there is a hope and a historic meeting. And that in itself is more of a step toward peace than these two nations have seen in more than 30 years. I'm Linda Ellerbe in Washington. More news later.
She served as an NBC reporter, and by 1978, she was co-anchoring NBC Weekend on Saturday nights at 10 o'clock, fighting Dallas and Fantasy Island for viewers.
His name is Lloyd Dobbins.
Her name is Linda Ellerbe.
And we're in Palm Springs, California, with former President Gerald Ford.
In your book, you say that you sat and you watched Richard Nixon's resignation speech on television, as most of us did, and that at the end, you thought to yourself, he has lost touch with reality. Now, I know what I mean when I say that. What did you mean?
I felt that the reasons given for his resignation were not the reasons that the American people wanted to hear.
The show was beaten soundly in the ratings and left the airwaves after nearly a year. For Ellerbe, it was back to NBC Nightly News, until she was named co-anchor of NBC News Overnight, again with Lloyd Dobbins and later Bill Schechner. They took the old time slot of Tom Snyder's Tomorrow Show and followed the then brand new Late Night with David Letterman. Overnight was widely regarded as one of the smartest news shows on all of television. It appealed to an eclectic audience of college students, nursing mothers, and late-shift workers. It was filled with information, wit, and even wisdom. Boring, it was not.
What follows are the first lines of some stories reported by the wire services Friday, exactly as the lines were written. Consider them evidence that news comes and goes, but the absurd is with us always. London, a Scotsman who battered his mother to death with a police truncheon and a brick 13 years ago, may soon become the first convicted murderer to enter the clergy. Toronto. A man has been found dead after falling headfirst into a vat of pizza dough, police said. London again. Scotland Yard, which has long enjoyed the benign image of the unarmed, helpful London bobby, is really dominated by hard drinking, sex, and violence, the report said. Boston. The same bacteria that causes a common form of venereal disease may be the major cause of sore throats in adults, medical researchers report. And finally, from Anaheim. He's ageless in his jaunty red shorts and big yellow shoes. But Mickey Mouse, 55 today, is no kid anymore. It doesn't say whether he's still a mouse. It is late. The weekend has already begun.
Anyone whose plans for Saturday require detailed weather forecasts is the sort of person who's probably already gone to sleep. Here's the map. There are the symbols. Yes, it's vague, but that way we're not wrong so often. This has nothing to do with that, but we will not let this program go by without reporting that the Housing Authority of Houston revealed on Wednesday a plan to spend $50,000 and provide classroom space to teach public housing tenants how to perform simple household chores, such as changing a light bulb. Ah, Texas, on the cutting edge of progress again. Here's some more news on a reel. It would be pleasant to show an hour of that, which, as best I can tell, is what someone wants us to do. Miriam Hefner of San Diego is one such person. This postcard is from her, and it says the president recently challenged the TV newsmen to dwell for a week, this week, on good news. She says it is her understanding my network has refused to do so, and it will be her pleasure to boycott my network for this period of time. Jacqueline Gibbs feels just the same. Exactly the same, since her postcard uses the same words and in the same print. Okay, it's a mail-in. We have dozens of those. And it's organized, and I'm sorry to disappoint Jacqueline and Miriam and my president, but I have seen networks that dwell on good news, thank you, and every single one of them was controlled by the state. Pollen's newscasts offered little but good news. We have this old-fashioned idea here that accuracy counts, and to be accurate means to include the depressing events of the day. It's hard to make a bombing in Beirut come out sounding like a tea party. Besides, news by definition is the exception. How sorry a state it would be to have to go on the air and report the number of planes which landed safely, the number of people who didn't harm one another. How sorry a state if those were the exceptions. They aren't. I guess in the best of all possible worlds, good news would mean no news. Nothing bad happened. If we get to that world, I'll let you know. That, Miriam, I promise. Until then, just consider the news a record of man's failures, if you want to. And if you insist on a record of man's accomplishments, may I suggest the sports pages. And so it goes.
And So It Goes was Ellerbee's trademark broadcast tagline and the title of her 1986 bestseller, And So It Goes, Adventures in Television. Though Overnight had many loyal fans, it was never a ratings success and was canceled after only 17 months. The last words?
Before we leave, thank you. Thank you for the more than 10,000 letters, telegrams, and calls. And for the toys, flowers, books, records, songs about Overnight, and the money which we sent back. What you said, we take with us. I think it's not as important that NBC took this program off the air as it is that NBC put this program on the air. That was something. We go smiling. The final quote is from Mark Twain, discussing the young missionary who went out among the cannibals. Said Twain, "They listened with the greatest of interest to everything he had to say, and then they ate him." This is the 367th edition of Overnight. There are no more. And so it goes.
The book, And So It Goes, was a big bestseller. It may also have gotten Ellerbee fired from NBC.
Anyway, this woman on Friday was employed by NBC right here as a news correspondent. Today, we're not really sure. Folks, please say hello to NBC news person and best-selling author Linda Ellerbee. Linda, come on out.
Sorry, you were here Thursday night and we ran out of time,
that's
so
right.
Please accept my apologies.
It's nicer to be here now when I'm unemployed.
It's television. Now, are you really unemployed?
Technically. My contract ran out at midnight last night.
And why is that? Why did that happen? Negotiations broke down?
Something like that, yes.
But why? Does it have anything to do with what you said in the book here?
Well, I don't know. Nobody that I work for has mentioned the book, that which might well explain it.
Did you hurt people's feelings?
No, I didn't. It's a kind book, and I wrote it on the assumption that my employers had a sense of humor. What could go wrong?
Ellerbee left NBC and went to ABC. She got a cool contract, made some money, and began to host Our World, a program to go opposite the ratings king of the day, The Cosby Show.
Welcome to Our World. Unbutton something. It's summer, 1972. Think of that summer as a novel, a mystery maybe. So who done it? Well, you'll have to read between the lines for the answer, but after all, that's where some of the best stuff gets written. For a clue, look for words starting with the letter M, like McGovern, Millhouse, Miz, Miami, MASH, Munich, and Mick.
Our World ended after 10 months. When the ABC deal and the money ran out, Ellerbe looked to start her own production company, Lucky Duck Productions. To do what she wanted to do, she needed money. How about a commercial?
I'm Linda Ellerbe. Today, we're going to Silver Spring, Maryland, to see if people there agree with national test results that said Maxwell House coffee is better than Folgers coffee. Willard?
Hey, Linda, I'm here with Sandra Allegra of the Early Risers Bowling League. Now, which coffee did you like better?
Maxwell House.
Ah.
Well, Ellerbe did get a certain amount of criticism for being a journalist doing a commercial. It did help get Lucky Duck off the ground, leading to a 25-year stint with Nickelodeon anchoring Nick News for Kids, where no subject was off the table.
A bomb was exploded in Oklahoma City, killing many people.
When the earthquake hit Haiti, the poorest country in the Western Hemisphere, it tore the place apart.
HIV infection is spreading. People in 157 countries.
You know, this country is at war in Iraq.
This was a poor city even before the storm, and this, the Lower Ninth Ward, its poorest neighborhood. There's a war going on in the Balkans, and while America is involved, here is what happened on September 11th, 2001.
Consider the country of Syria in the Middle East. For the last few years, Syria has been at war with itself. That earthquake caused a giant tsunami to slam Japan's northeastern coast. Soldiers' kids sometimes have to take on grown-up responsibilities. These kids sometimes have to stop being kids.
The world is suffering from a recession, and some kids have seen their lives totally upended because
American troops have been fighting in Afghanistan since 2001.
Ellerbe spent half her career reporting the news to adults and the other half explaining the news to children. On December 15th, 2015, she retired, 43 years after her first job in journalism.
It's been a great ride, all of it, but it's time to go. I go smiling from Nick News and from television. So now, for the last time, let me say, I'm Linda Ellerbe. Goodbye for Nick News. And so it goes.
It's the only time I ever said, and so it goes, on Nick News.
Is that true? We're on the air now, but
yeah.
That's amazing.
Yeah. I didn't, because when we started Nick News, and I'm talking to kids, and I thought, I can't end these broadcasts by saying, and so it goes. They are children. I do not want to inculcate them with the idea that things cannot be changed or fixed.
Yeah.
And that well, this is just how the world goes, and that you must accept that. So I didn't say it. I never said it. Until that very last night. But that was my goodbye to television.
That's
as well,
right.
It
made sense.
Yeah.
Well, first of all, thank you for staying on. I can't tell you what a special, special day this is for us. You know, putting that together was one of the most fun.
Nice job, by the way.
Thank you. And thanks to Sarah for clipping it all together and producing it so beautifully. You know, I going through those clips and I realized what an impact you had had on me. As a journalist, it's no secret I'm a huge Letterman fan, and so I started watching that show. And when you came on after, I would watch that, and I was transfixed by what you were doing. Terry mentioned this earlier, and it was just so amazing. And then when your book came out, and so it goes, that became like the Bible. And I never knew, I couldn't figure out whether I wanted to be on radio or television. I had cable access was just coming in. I had a little, in high school, I had a little cable access TV show. And I didn't like it, but I love being on the radio. And I love broadcasting. And the one thing that that book helped me realize is, A, I didn't want to be on television. and B, that you could make a difference. And broadcasting was still very, very important. And so it's just a great, great pleasure to have you here and for you to stick around and let us talk to you a little bit. So thank you very, very much.
It is my pleasure, Joe.
We ended with Nick News, and there's a little montage in there of all the stories that you covered. And I was struck. You ended our last half hour by telling your great Donald Trump story. But, you know, I was struck by you did an interview with Robin Roberts at the end, your final interview before your retirement. And they said, is there anything you're going to miss? And you mentioned, as you mentioned on our show, that it was the first campaign that you had sat out since 1972. Mm-hmm. And Robin Roberts said, are you sad about that? And you said, well, no, because I don't know how I would explain Donald Trump to children.
Yeah. I still don't know. I really don't. How any of the ways that I would believe are the right way to explain it would make some people very angry and would make other people say, well, she's not objective. Well, you know my feelings on that. There's no such thing as objective. You go to a story, you bring everything you've ever seen, written, read, heard. You bring yourself to that story. Now, you try to be fair. You try to give it a fair look. But you don't show up as a tabula rasa. That's not, even a computer can't name a random number. Yeah. And I could look at this thing with Donald Trump, and I thought, and this wasn't, by the way, this wasn't because, boy, I think Hillary is so great. This was about knowing that there was no equivalency there, that it was not the same thing at all, that politically and ideologically, you might say, well, they're very different, but they're similar, but one is sane and one is not, period. And how could I go on and give them the same amount of time and treat it as though it was equal without saying, you know, there's something wrong with this man. And he's a liar, and he's always been a liar.
It seems so telling because of, again, in that montage, of all the stories that you covered, of whether it was 9/11 or the program you did on AIDS was, I think, one of the most amazing pieces of journalism I've ever seen. And that you can put that into a context, but then this guy comes around and it's like,
befuddled
now
me.
What do we do?
Befuddled me. I had no idea how I would explain it, because what we had done in previous elections was we would do, our shows were single subject shows. So we do one show on the bios of the candidates. Okay. And one shows on their policies. And then we do one show where we'd go around the country and we'd videotape children asking what they wanted to ask the candidates. Now, this is obviously after the primaries. This is when it's down to two, or in 1 year it was three because we had Ross Perot and we included him. And then the presidents would sit down with us and we would play those tapes, the candidates. And they would answer them, and they would answer them seriously. And now I could not see how I could put on a biography of Donald Trump knowing how much of it was a lie, what he was putting out. I live in New York. I'd lived there 40 years. I'd watched this man go bankrupt. I'd watched him stiff working companies and people he'd used. You could say, but her emails. Well, yeah, but his history, his work. So I couldn't do that. And then when it came down to, okay, well, what are their policies? Well, he didn't really have policies other than to call people by names. We had already done an hour show on the if not dissolution, the at least devolving of civil intercourse in the public arena in America. There was nothing about this campaign that I wanted to cover, and no way I could figure out to explain it to what my own truth believed with all my heart, to even pretend to seem fair. And when it got down to the end, and when it got down to the point where only one of two people was going to occupy the White House, either Hillary Clinton or Donald Trump was going to be president. And the only way to keep him out was to actively go and vote her in. Sitting back and saying, you know, Bernie didn't get the nomination, so I'm not going to vote, was a vote for Trump. Mm-hmm. Voting for Jill Stein was a vote for Trump. Just not liking or not voting because they're all both equal was a vote for Trump. And in the end, I can't tell you what a Hillary Clinton presidency would look like right now. But I can tell you that we wouldn't be going through the daily national depression that we're going through right now.
Linda Ellerbe is our guest. We're going to take a quick break. When we come back, we'll continue our conversation with her. We welcome any questions you have. It's panel@wamc.org, panel@wamc.org. And we will be right back after this short break.
If you ask me, I think anybody, any one of you, after having gone through the process, anyone who goes through that whole process and gets to the White House probably is somebody you don't want there. I remember back in 1980, a group of us wanted to save the American people and press a lot of time and money, cancel all the debates, cancel the campaign, and just put Rosalynn Carter and Nancy Reagan into a pit. And whichever one of them came out, her husband could be president.
Oh, Jesus.
I know which one I would have bet on.
I can't believe I said that.
That is from a television program called Tanner 88. It was written by Gary Trudeau, who was our guest earlier this week on The Book Show. And Robert Altman was the director. I assume that Robert Altman calling you up and saying, would you like to be on, is something that you can't say no to.
You know, you're exactly right. Because if you're on television and you're a television reporter, particularly if you're female, you're going to get calls from a lot of movie companies saying, can you come and play yourself in our movie? And since in most cases they want to play me, they wanted to play a female correspondent as an idiot with, you know, who'd blow dried her brains right along with her hair, I would constantly say, no, thank you. It's very nice of you to ask me. No, thank you. A woman called one day and she said, we have a movie that we'd like you to play yourself in. It's going to be an HBO series. And I said, no, thank you. And she said, Robert Altman is directing it. I said, tell me when to show up. I wanted to meet Robert Altman. So I went to California and I worked there on the set for about 4 days. And I wrote my own words. That's how he worked. It was ad-libbed, most of it. He'd say, here's where the scene is going. Now you say whatever you want in it. And in the course of that, I met a little girl, a young girl who was playing a teenager on the program. And I was terrified to be on the program, first of all, because I'm not an actor. And I know I'm not. And I proved it on Murphy Brown several times. I was terrified to be there on that set. It's Robert Altman. And this young girl was very comforting to me and very kind. And, okay, I'm old. My memory slips. I finished doing this. Much time passes, and we're doing a biography for the Lifetime Channel on Cynthia Nixon because of Sex and the City. And we meet for the interview, and she says, don't you remember me? I was the little girl on Tanner 88.
That's right. That's right. It was that was quite. I want to let me just ask you this. Let's play the clip. This is a clip from you. You mentioned Murphy Brown. This is a clip of you on Murphy Brown. This is in the first season. It was, I think, the second to the last episode of the first season of Murphy Brown. And here you are. It was called an episode called Summer of 72.
God, I wanted that job.
And I did not steal And So It Goes from you. I stole it from Lloyd Dobbins.
You're kidding. Gee, maybe I should apologize for putting your name in the personal section of Soldier of Fortune magazine.
We're even. I'm the one told Irving R. Levine you had the hots for him.
Well, what goes round comes round. Seems like we've traded places over the years.
You're happy with the way things turned out, though?
I wouldn't have it any other way.
Me neither. Although, I was thinking of going back to a regular network job.
I was thinking of taking some time off, maybe writing a book.
Nah.
So on that episode, there is a commentary track by Diane English, who's the creator of the program. And so two interesting things leapt out at me when she was talking about that scene. One is that the show, Murphy Brown, and you, I think, have had a love-hate relationship with this particular version of the story, but that Murphy Brown was based on you. And in that commentary, she said, Linda Ellerbe inspired the character of Murphy Brown.
Yeah, I I may have been part of a number of women who inspired it. On the other hand, Diane English called me and said, we want to do a show about a network anchor woman whose mouth constantly gets her in trouble. Could we follow you around for a month?
How could you say no to that?
How could you say no to that?
Now, and the other thing she said in that commentary was that she had written words for you, and they were words that she felt were Linda Ellerbee-like.
Yes.
And you said, I think I know what's more Linda Ellerbee-like than you know what's Linda Ellerbee-like.
Actually, it wasn't that. It was I was much kinder than that, because Diane is a very good writer, and I'm not an actress. And we were in some scene, and I kept saying a line that didn't make her happy the way I was saying it. And she said, you know, I wrote every line that you're saying in this show, and I tried it out on myself, and I would say, is this Linda Ellerbee-like? And I said, well, if I'm Linda Ellerbee and I say the line, isn't that Linda Ellerbee-like? And she said, not really. So I said, okay, here's the deal. You say the line, Linda Ellerbee-like, and I'll just say it the way you said it. And that's what we did.
Are you watching the reboot?
I saw the first one. I have not seen any after the first one.
Now, my understanding was that most people, when the show was originally on, that people in the profession loved it.
We did. It was lovely to see some of the actual workings that went on inside television news portrayed fairly accurately, or at least better than they had been in the past. It was also fun. They got an awful lot of us on television to come and play ourselves on it because it was fun to do. The reboot, I don't know. I watched it. I wanted to like it. But most of the jokes felt very 1990-ish.
Yeah.
I wanted it to be a little sharper. And I'm sure, given that talented cast and writers, that it will become that way.
It is, but it's also one of those things that the way I've felt watching it is that it's just lovely to have everybody back again. I
felt that. I absolutely did. I went, oh, there's Grant. there's Corky.
I'm looking for anything of comfort these days,
yes.
And I find that to be
it's
to
a
be
blanny.
Comforting.
It's like a blanny. You
yes.
Know?
It is very much.
It may have been through the wash, but it's still our blanny.
When you... I want to talk about Overnight for a little bit. Overnight, as I think as I said in the piece that we ran, and then Terry was talking about it as well, this was a show that, in its own way, revolutionized television. And, I mean, you were saying earlier that, okay, the bosses were asleep while you were doing it, but it really did change the way you think of how we look at television now. And what you were doing, I mean, I assume you didn't think of it as revolutionary, or maybe you did. I don't know.
No, we didn't. We just did. Lloyd and I did some things or didn't do some things that we disapproved of. For example, one little thing. We never spoke to each other on the show.
Yeah.
We both had this strong feeling that if we were up there, our audience was our audience, and we should be speaking to our audience and not to each other. We saw each other much of the day. We could have any conversation we needed off the air. And we both disliked, and I dislike it to this day, and I dislike it when NPR does it. Hi, Beth. How are you? Well, now tell me about that killing in Pittsburgh. Well, John, I'm doing well. I'm fine. Now let me tell you about that killing in Pittsburgh. No, we never did that. We also never once said who we were on the air. We never said our names. I never said, I'm Linda Ellerbee and good night. He never said, I'm Lloyd Dobbins. So there was no chit-chat. There was none of that. We also had rules that we chose to make, which was that we would try to check sources a lot. And we worked with people who believed in that. We also felt that we acted as though the audience had as much sense as we did, at least as much sense as we did. And therefore, they were following along with us, and we did not have to take time to go back and explain everything to them, that we could move stories forward, which was the absolute opposite of Nick News, where I learned that we needed to take the time to go back and say, once upon a time, and start a story that way, because kids saw the grown-up news as a slice of pizza, but not the whole pizza.
Right.
So it was two very different ways. On Nick News, it was a once upon a time. On Overnight, it was a, come on, you're with us. We know you're with us, and we're with you. We could have inside jokes. We could keep things going here.
And there was, you would use foreign news services? You would
absolutely. Use... We used, because we had no money, every day at 4 o'clock in the afternoon, NBC took in a lot of free feeds that came in back in those days from news services all around the world, many of them not in English, but they were free. And we would sit and screen them, and we would take stories from them and then translate them and put them on the air. We would also take American stories and show how the rest of the world was covering it. So, for example, if we were covering the story of the confirmation process of the Secretary of State of the United States, we did it by showing how the four major NATO allies covered that story. So it was a way of giving more information without having to take the time to give more information.
When you think about ultimately what you could get in an hour, you also realize you could get in a lot of real news.
You know, when Reuven Frank, who started Overnight, also started the Huntley Brinkley Report and moved it for 15 minutes to a half hour, and everybody said, well, you know, nobody will sit through half an hour. Overnight was the model for the hour news show that he wanted to make happen.
I'm going to hold you there because we have to take a break. When we come back, we'll continue and we'll talk more about Overnight. We'll talk more about other aspects of your career. And Wendell Ellerbe is with us. We couldn't be more thrilled. We'll be right back after this short break. Wendell Ellerbe is a Peabody and Emmy Award-winning journalist who was one of the first women to anchor the national news. Her work at NBC was groundbreaking, followed by her best-selling books and her important presence for a quarter of a century explaining the news to young people on Nick News. She has been our guest this morning, and we have a few more moments with her, which I'm thrilled about. Let us talk for a moment about the when Overnight, we were talking about Overnight right before the break. You had mentioned Reuven Frank a couple of times. This man, and I really only know of him through reading your books and then subsequently reading about him. But he was really a pioneer because Weekend was his idea. Overnight was his idea. He had an interesting vision for news, especially at a network level.
He did, and he also had an interesting vision for television that has been lost. One of the many wise things he said to me was, he said, okay, take the Today Show, for example, and he said, now go in the other room, or take any news show, nightly news, anything. Now turn it on, the television, and go in the other room and listen to it like you're getting made up in the morning or like you're cooking dinner. Listen, and he said, if everything is understandable to you from the other room, there is a word for that, and that word is radio. He said, television ought to compel you to watch it. The pictures come first. The words come second. So I became one of the, at that time, only two correspondents who would cut the picture first and then go back and add narration only where it was absolutely necessary. And let the stories be told by the picture and by the people in the stories. And we continued that at Nick News.
But your writing is what, I mean, your writing is gorgeous.
Well, my writing goal was always to see how much I could not write. The first show that I did on a show called Weekend for Reuven, the piece was 20 minutes long and I wrote 34 seconds of narration. So I thought I was close to achieving my goal. And in fact, the first piece that I cut, which was a summation of the 1980 election that aired on Nightly News, and I had put the whole thing together with sound bites and music. It was a 6-minute piece, and John Chancellor refused to introduce me when he introduced the piece. He refused to say, and here is this piece from Linda Ellerbe, because he said, there is no narration. How could she have written it? Mm. I wrote it with the picture.
Right.
And that's what Reuven taught me.
Yeah.
That and things like there's never a shortage of, I can't say that word, a-holes.
this just flashed into my mind. And I remember This is actually one of the first. This is when I realized that you lived here around here. Was the movie Broadcast News came out, and you wrote a review of it.
I wrote the review for the London Times, and it was picked up, and it ran, you know, in other papers around here.
But
yeah.
I think you told the story about like leaving in your Jeep, going from the Berkshires, coming over to Albany here to see the movie.
Yes,
and I remember that vividly. But there again was another kind of an insight into what that world was like. When you mentioned John Chancellor, I think of the character of, of the Jack Nicholson character, but of course also the William Hurt character.
Yeah, the William Hurt character exists. And the lines in that movie that still resonate today are mostly Albert Brooks' lines.
Brilliant.
But they are lines such as, you know, when the devil comes, he's not going to be wearing horns and a forked tail. He's going to look personable. He's going to be good on the air, and he's just going to lower our national intelligence bit by bit by bit, and we won't notice while it's happening.
And that's essentially what strikes me though is, I mean, that movie certainly captured that. Your book captured that. That was 1986. This was really before cable news had dug in.
Yeah.
And I'm interested in what the last few decades have been with cable news. I know you worked for CNN briefly.
No, I didn't. I would go on and do commentary for them on a, you know, case by case basis. I was never employed by CNN.
And you never, there was never a, because people say this about SiriusXM to me sometimes. It's like, well, it's all radio. And you're like, yeah, it is, but it's not like real radio. And I felt like I sort of feel that way. I mean, I would think, oh, there's an opportunity that I can be a journalist 7 days a week for 24 hours a day, but okay, but it's not really what I want to do.
Yeah. Well, you know, we did a 90-minute film at Lucky Duck called Feeding the Beast, which was about the advent of 24-hour news and how it changed, how having to feed the beast constantly, how it changed how we reported the news and how the news was received in a lot of various ways. And it was a learning experience for me because in you know, journalists don't know anything. We're just paid to go out and ask people who do know things and, you know, ask them and get the answers. And in talking to people about this, it was clear to me exactly how much it had changed. Everything. Reuven used to say no story was ever lost for 30 seconds conscious thought.
Mm.
Well, it is lost in the cable news network for 30 seconds conscious thought. You don't have that extra 30 seconds. You have to be on the air now. If it happens, you're on the air now. Go. You lose a lot of reasoned thought in that. And you end up on the air with people saying a lot of things that you know later on that night they're going, I wish I hadn't said that. Or I could have said that better. Or that's not what I meant to say. A lot of bad falls from that. Not all bad. It's not all bad. It is good. You know, it is not. Look, to this day, if there is a story that is so, has so much to do with the picture, okay, I'm from Houston. When Hurricane Harvey hit my hometown, I did not turn on NPR, though that is usually my go-to network.
Right.
When I want to, quote, see the news clearly. I turned on CNN. I needed to see that story. I don't need to see Donald Trump, what he says every day.
Now, given that, and given the news cycle that we're in, I'm struck by CNN specifically because I watch that more than I watch MSNBC. So it's difficult for me to, although I think it's very similar, where it's all about the panel and the group of people, and the reporters who are working their sources on the phone while they're on the set, and then will report as it happens. My point being that there aren't packages. There aren't stories.
There aren't.
And now here's Linda Ellerbe with a story from
that looks into
Houston.
Something that we're talking about. No, there's no time for that and no money. In television news right now, it goes like this. There are giant salaries paid to the anchors of the giant shows. And then there are a bunch of people paid very low salaries. Okay, when and this is nothing against Tom Brokaw, so I don't mean this personally. It just happened when he was anchoring nightly news at NBC. He was making, $6-7 million a year, maybe right. more. The man who wrote the words that he said every night was making $24,000 a year. But he was writing the words that Brokaw said. Now, you know, what happened as the networks grew up also is as we got older, they discovered, well, I can hire four Linda Ellerbees for the price, you know, four 20-year-old Linda Ellerbees for the price of one Linda Ellerbee. It doesn't matter that there's no historical context or that they've only read two books so far. You know, it'll be cheaper. And you see it in your business.
Sure.
We can lose this producer and this on-air talent, on-air person, and we could still get it on. It may not be as good, but by God, unless the audience ups and rebels, it'll work.
Well, and then you always feel like, well, if we do it and we do a good job, then who wins?
I don't think anybody wins if we do a good job. I think everybody loses when we do a bad one.
Yeah, that's a way to look at it. Yeah. That's perfect. There was a Letterman, not the clip that we played about with you right after you left NBC, but there was one during the writer's strike where you came on the show and you were wearing the T-shirt supporting the union.
Yes, yeah. Absolutely.
And I remember you talking about some of those inconsistencies.
Broadcast news is just filled with inconsistencies. it just boggles the mind. My favorite story of all time about broadcast news goes back to the Tonight Show many years ago, and I happened to be watching, and it was Tony Randall was the guest, and he asked Johnny Carson, he said, you know, I've been doing television for years, and he said, but I don't really understand how this works, and he sort of gestured to the room, and Johnny Carson said, oh, he said, well, I can explain it to you. He says, there's three cameras, this one, this one, this one, and there's a control room over there, and the director will say, punch up camera two, and that will come on this. And Tony Randall said, no, that's not what I mean. I know how that works. What I don't understand is how we sit here and talk, and it spills out in someone's living room in Topeka. And Carson looked at him and said, oh, that part? Well, that's a miracle. And that's always been my feeling about television. Rolf, my beloved partner of 32 years, the man has tried to explain the little yellow wires and the little green wires and the little blue wires to me for 32 years. And to me, it's all still a miracle.
Right. Yeah, no, I don't understand. But I speak here and it winds up in somebody's car radio. I don't know how that happens. But thank God it does. It's kept me employed.
Yeah, and me. It kept me well employed. I was hugely lucky. I really did. I wasn't kidding in that interview with Robin. I had a great time.
Yeah.
I really did. Well, I had shows canceled. I had other things happen that weren't so much fun, but I had a great time.
You said at the end of the Nick News, I leave smiling.
I did. I absolutely, and it was, I also left it being my choice, which a lot of people my age don't get
so
anymore.
A couple of miscellaneous things. One is in the clip that we were playing from Letterman, I remember this. I remember for two reasons. One of them is you were talking about NBC, and you turned to Letterman and you said, I hope this isn't making you comfortable. And Letterman said, I haven't been comfortable since I was 13. I remember that line as being one of the great lines of all time.
He was a very funny man.
Yes. But the other thing is he said to you, this is in 86, well before Johnny, but he said that part of the contract negotiations, and I didn't know about this, but part of the contract negotiations, and one of the things that was brought up of you hosting The Tonight Show.
Yes.
Now, was that permanent or guest or what?
No, that was at the time when they were flirting with a permanent guest host.
Yeah.
So it was a combination of both. And they talked to me about, would I be interested in being the permanent guest host? This came about because Johnny Carson was a news junkie.
Right.
Who knew? But he was, and he loved having those of us from the news division at NBC who could come on and tell a story to have us come on and do that. He loved it. So I was on his show a lot. And I did guest host it once or twice. And from that came these rumors that, you know, I was going to do that. That was never going to happen.
Right.
Never going to happen. They offered me the job of anchoring the CBS Morning News. And I was offered the job of Our World at ABC, and that's the one I chose.
I want to play, I debated a long time of whether I was going to play this clip or not, and it'll become obvious as to why I debated it for so long. But this is you as a guest on The Tonight Show, where you're promoting Our World. All right? So Our World has just come out, and there's a guest host that night, and it's Bill Cosby. All right, here's this clip.
Actually, I owe you. If it weren't for you, we wouldn't have this show. Really, because ABC, his show is so popular that ABC decided that Ripley's Believe It or Not, which was opposite you,
yes,
cost a lot of money and didn't get very good ratings. So they decided that a news show, of course, cost half the money to produce. And if we didn't get very good ratings, it was okay because they were still making money. It didn't cost a lot of money to produce. So if you weren't there, I wouldn't be here.
Now, I don't know how, in your family, has anybody really gotten after you for going up against a show that is as popular as The Cosby Show?
Well, yeah, I mean, people do say, what is your wish? You know, what, you have a death wish? Why do you insist on continuing to work with no net? And I say right away that I admit Bill Cosby is funnier than I am. But the pay is good, mm-hmm. and the show is good. And the other nice thing about being opposite you is it's easy for people to remember when it's on. Well, it's on opposite Cosby.
Oh, my God, how times can change. Huh?
The things we didn't know.
Yeah.
You know, early on in television, not because of Bill Cosby, but because of another man in television, I had a very hard and clear lesson that you can lie to the camera, that nothing lies as easy as a camera, and that it was quite possible to be perceived on the air as a good and kind human person, and to be not that in real life.
For you as a reporter, of knowing the anchors, of knowing the other reporters, did you just not want to know a lot of that? I mean, of course, part of your career, you're doing it in the middle of the night, so you have a lot.
Yeah, nobody knows
you have
it anyway.
A lot of, but you certainly spent your time at the Today Show and NBC Nightly News.
There are situations that were hugely uncomfortable. You talk about hostile workplace. If you have a man on a show who's anchoring a show, and he's married to a woman of one race, but he brings his mistress of another race into the show regularly, it puts everyone on that show in a very awkward position, okay? Not because of the racial part, but because of the cheating on the spouse part. Me too. I can say that absolutely honestly. Now, nobody ever said, if you don't do this, you won't get a job. But the hostile workplace, absolutely. Finding reasons to brush up against your breast, thinking it's okay to pinch you in the ass as you go by in the elevator, making suggestive remarks, telling you that your lady things look really good today. It was just a fact of life. It was how it was, and it was horrible.
I don't know that this surprised anybody, but I'll ask it as that question, which is, as the Me Too movement started to unfold, the one of the industries that was hardest hit, of course, was broadcast journalism.
Sure.
I mean, Matt Lauer and Charlie Rose, I personally wasn't surprised by that, but I know a lot of people were, because these were people that were.
You see them on the air, you think you know them.
Right.
That's not necessarily true. It is with some. It's not necessarily not true. There are many very nice people in there, but there are some who are not, and there are some who just simply aren't what they seem to be.
Well, that was one of the things that I thought was always so fascinating about your career, is that, I'm interested in what you think about this, but we always felt that we knew you. We had a pretty good sense of who you were. You were there. You were comfortable. You were wearing jeans. You had sneakers on. You seemed like you were very much at ease.
Well, I think also one of the things we did on Overnight was we closed the show with a quick little personal essay, and Lloyd and I would alternate every other night on who did it. And that was a way, and it was intentional, it was a way for the audience to get to know us as people just a little bit. One of the premises of Overnight was let's see how much of this screen between me and you we can erase.
Mm.
So that meant you had to let them in a little bit. You had to trust the viewer enough to let them into your life. I mean, I remember going on one night and talking about my mother had died.
Yeah.
And telling a story about that. I remember another time going on and telling something that was, you know, something stupid I'd done. But they were ways to let people know, this is who I am. I'm not just who you see reading words that I wrote earlier.
The fact, you mentioned Lloyd Dobbins. I mean, my favorite Lloyd Dobbins story has appeared in your first book of you covering the campaign and why you... why you don't drink at bars at Hilton Hotels or Hyatt Hotels.
Hyatt.
Well,
I don't drink at all. But
well,
this
no,
was
you do,
Lloyd's.
You give up.
Yeah.
Yeah, this was, yeah, that's right. Well, you tell that story in another book.
We were, okay, when you're on a campaign trail, a presidential campaign trail, you are in a different town every night.
Right.
And you may be in five cities during a day. And this was during the time the Hyatt Hotels were very popular with all those inner atriums that went 26 stories up.
Right.
And Lloyd woke up in the middle of the night on the campaign and thought he knew exactly where the bathroom was and didn't feel a need to turn on lights in his room. And he opened the door to what he thought was the bathroom and stepped out into what was the hall and peed over the balcony 22 floors down into the atrium, which was a bar and it was still open and people were sitting there.
Look, honey, it's Lloyd Dobbins. Yes.
Oh, gosh.
So now Lloyd is still with us, right?
Lloyd, yes. Yes and no. I wish I had better news on that. Lloyd is in a nursing home in North Carolina. He has had several strokes.
Oh, that's a shame.
And he is not having a happy ending or happy third act to his life at all. And I deeply regret it.
He was a good, you two were good partners. And then he left. He had an offer during Overnight.
He did,
Overnight.
And then Schechner came in. Schechner was a terrific partner, too. And then Ray Gandolf at Our World. I was fortunate enough to work with extremely good writers and good partners. And since we had the same sort of goals in mind, there was never any problems with us. Never.
Well, I'm finally going to let you out of here. You get to go home. But I'll tell you, I can't thank you enough for coming in and spending so much time with us. This is has been a dream of mine. I teach a class over at St. Rose, and students will often ask, you know, is there anyone you have been? I've interviewed you before, but mm-hmm. I've never met you before. And so this is a great thrill, and I think it's a thrill for everyone in this building that you're here. And we thank you so much for spending the time.
Thank
with
you
us.
For letting me. And if you'll give me just a moment, I just want to say one thing. I'm talking strictly to women out there. If you vote for any Republican at all next week, you are voting against yourself. Just understand that and decide whether you want to vote against your own self-interest.
Do you think, now I have to follow that up, but do you think that message is getting out enough?
I hope so. I really hope so.
Because there's a part of me that thinks if it doesn't get through now, when is it going to get through?
I don't know when it's going to get through now. Look, it was women defeated the ERA. We are our own worst enemy, and we're not a minority. As Jen so eloquently put it, we're not all the same either.
Right.
But right now, it makes no sense to me to be a Republican female and vote Republican if you're a female. If nothing else, did you not watch Kavanaugh?
Right.
Did you not watch his face? The one thing I know is that I don't know a single woman who since then hasn't said, we all say to one another, we've all known that guy. We all knew him.
Well, we'll see what happens in next Tuesday. And we'll,
we will.
And
keeping my fingers crossed.
And I know it's a lot to ask you to come back. I hope someday you will come back.
I will come back. Absolutely.
Excellent.
Yeah.
Well, that made my day. Linda Ellerbe, we love you. Thank you so much.
My pleasure.
Great pleasure. We'll be back. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.